You are listening to the Tech Gaming Podcast, episode 10-5. I am your host, Robert W. Eagle. Along with me today is Save Samurai Morris Green, Eric Blue Swim, and filling in for Sean, Shanola Kirkland, is the lawman, Jeremy Lamont. So let's jump into things. Start with Blue. Tell me about Operation Panties, dude.
I got so fed up with it that I'm just like, fuck it. Switched the thing off, did not bother to save my data. I basically threw away 3 hours worth of work, and I'm like, I cannot fucking take this anymore. And then, you know, later that day or the next day or whatever, I game faxed it and, you know, found out what I needed to do and went back in, and stage didn't take me that long, boss battle didn't take me that long. And I mean, even though I got through it, it was such a... It was such a task mentally on me.
It becomes no longer enjoyable. It's almost punishment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, even with Donkey Kong Country Returns, it's like, you know, there were some pain in the ass trial and error segments in there. But because of how quickly the game would load back up to the checkpoint, it's like you had about enough time to go, fuck! And then you start right back up again. And pretty like that too, but it's 10 times as frustrating because of how difficult it is. And I mean, I'm avoiding playing on baby mode, but that was the mode that they added for the sequel, where if you play on baby mode, the logo or the health indicator is replaced with diapers.
Good.
And like some pits will have blocks over them and stuff like that, and you know I'm trying to avoid playing on that, but I mean I'm at the point where I'm just mentally spent on the game, and I put it down, and I haven't, even though I got through that one section, haven't been ready to put myself through that torment again. I mean it started out. Not that bad. I got through about 3 stages or so. I had a boss battle with Flan on a pogo stick called Super Puffer or something like that. And, you know, I'm like, okay, yeah, you know, this is tough, but it's not overwhelming. And, I mean, I hate to say it, but after that, it was kind of like the jumping off point. Everything was just completely frustrating. I wasn't cursing that much up until that point. but when I hit that one stage and, you know, went through 200 printies, I mean, I was at the point where I was shouting at the thing, "Eat shit and die!" I mean, I was whipping out every insult in the book at that thing, or close to it.
Wow, I'm starting to think that I have to, but...
So speaking of Disgaea, let me talk a little bit about Disgaea 3. Show of hands, who's actually played a game in the Disgaea series?
Me, dude.
Jeremy?
My hand's not up. No.
Sage?
Me neither, I'm sorry. You guys talk about it so much that I feel like at this point I should probably check it out, but I've never really had an interest.
I'm going to FedEx one to you guys right away. So anyway, I got to admit, with Disgaea 3, Absence of Justice, that was the PS3 version, that was actually my least favorite game in the series, and the series now on its fourth iteration. But I think for me, even a subpar Disgaea is better than 90% of the games out there. And when I first played the PS3 version, except for Mao, he's the lead character, and he's this otaku that's obsessed with killing his father, the overlord, just because he erased his million-hour save file. other than him, I really didn't care for the other characters. There's like Almez, and who's this one guy. Obviously, there's a character arc. He's slowly becoming a demon there. But I didn't get into the game until the cameos started appearing. And I always think that that's kind of a weakness, where you have to bring your favorite characters back there. So anyway, that came out, I believe it was 2008. So 4 years later, here we are. I returned to Disgaea 3. In the form of the Vita adaptation, and this one's entitled Absence of Detention. And I gotta say, I like it more. I like the experience more. The characters, of course, are the same, but there's a bit of expansion in some of the narrative, courtesy of all the, what they did was they took all the PS3 DLC and they bundled it on the cart or on the download. So, and also I think my expectations are tempered a little bit this time. I mean, Justice was basically the reason why I bought a PS3, crazy enough. But so I know what's going on with the characters, and so I'm enjoying maybe the game mechanics more than the actual story. So one of the things I have to point out is that this could have been an easy port, but Nipponichi, they really went all out, not just with the extra content, but like the animations for battles, the dialogue, the as Sean would say, the paper dolls are all animated nicely. The game looks, especially on the small screen, except for the funky perspective issues that were always there in battle, the game looks great. So basically they're offering a huge just time sink for players, just to, you know, they can level up their character into the stratosphere. And as Vita games go, I think it can't be beat for greatest value for the money. I put in about 30 hours last couple weeks and really enjoyed it. There are some for people maybe new to the series, there's not a lot of explanation and there are some difficulty spikes, but I find it pretty rewarding. So
I have a question here. So this is sir, a game that you've played before then, is that right?
Yes, yeah, I played it on the PS3. And the thing was, on the PS3 you can probably pick it up for about $15 and now it's $40, but it does have all the DLC.
Well, also it's like it's portable. I mean, that,
yeah.
I mean, usually with the PS, you know, with the first two Disgaea games, the PSP version was usually, I think it's fair to say, the definitive version, because they added some extra content to it and expanded on it, and it's probably the case with this, too.
I think with Disgaea 2, I'm not sure how much they added with the first Disgaea. I could be wrong. I probably should know.
They added Etna mode.
You can go through
the scenario where she actually killed Laharl, what would happen, I believe it
was. That's right, at the very end, yes. Yes, that's right. Spoiler alert for a 10-year-old game. Sorry. Anything else, Jeremy? Jeremy, you got to play Disgaea 3.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's something that, like Sage said, you know, you guys talk about that quite a lot, and I feel a little bit like an outsider looking in on this thing. I mean, between the strategy RPG elements and then the platformer, I'm not quite sure what to make of it, but it seems to, you know, be really well received by the people who like it. I suppose that's about all I really know.
You know what it is? I'll probably start my review. Is people ask me, is someone who reviews games, what's your favorite game? And I always talk about the Disgaea series. And 95% of people have never heard of it, but 5% of people will roll up their arm sleeve and show me like their Etna tattoo or something, you know, just like totally crazy about it. And it's this weird dynamic where, you know, it's real cultish, which is kind of strange. I'm not quite in that tattoo area yet.
You don't have a tattoo?
No, I have no tattoos.
Are you going to get a tattoo?
No.
But I want you to get a tattoo.
I'm not going to.
Sorry. If you had no choice.
Especially of a video game character. No, here's my thing about tattoos, and I'm sorry if I offend anyone in the audience. Like, they're cool, but then when you get a little bit older, like, even the coolest thing in the world just gets all saggy and colored, and it's not cool anymore.
Yeah, but AC/DC logo is going to look like crap in 25 years.
Yeah. But in the future, they'll be able to, like, baby soft stretch your skin back out, and they'll be able to take tattoos off with, like, a wipey and put new ones on, and, I mean, so it won't
matter.
Plus,
you can always get a tramp stamp, and then nobody will know it's there except you and maybe your special someone.
Or multiple special someones.
Press start to play.
All right, moving on.
I think I want to get that tattooed on me now.
Yuck. Anyway, I've been playing some Harry Potter, which was the other Vita title. Well, the Lego Harry Potter. You know, I like the Lego games. And I played years 1 through 5 on the console. I played it with my nieces a little bit. And I really liked the original game. I thought it offered a good blend of casting. But when you're shooting with your wand at puzzles collection. And the Vita adaptation is fundamentally solid. The frame rate is okay, probably much better than the 3DS Lego games. And it doesn't have the disappearing studs of that version. Like, you know, there was only a limited number of studs that would appear on the screen. But it feels radically different for me from the first console version. For one thing, combat has been scaled back immensely so that the puzzles kind of take the front seat there. And without a second player or even an AI drone, the game feels a little bit lonely. You know, those puzzles where one person would just sit on the Switch and then do something else. At least, I don't know, your experience wasn't so solitary, and this one feels pretty empty in Harry's world. I don't know, I can't recommend Harry Potter as a full-price purchase. It's $40 both in card form and downloadable. WB didn't even give people a discount. You know, I'm a fan of the Lego games. I think they're one of the few games that can cater both to adults and children, keep them both entertained. But as it stands, I think $20 even is a bit much for this game because it just feels a little bit tedious. Not very fun. You know,
so what if years 5 to 7 is actually the recommended age group? What do you think then?
I think they'd get frustrated with some of the puzzles. So I'd move it to 7 to 12, maybe. Because I admit I got stuck on at least two of the puzzles? And it wasn't that they were really cerebral. It was like, oh, you want me to do that? I didn't expect, you know.
You know, I've found that's kind of the problem with the Lego games. They really seem to, you know, they seem really obscure. I mean, everybody talks about how great they are for kids and how, you know, they can play with their, you know, their 5-year-old or their, you know, their grade schooler. But I have found on more than one occasion, I mean, it happened to me a lot in Star Wars. It happened in, you know, all kinds of games where you get to a point and they don't really telegraph to you where it is you're supposed to go. And so you end up just stuck there.
Daddy, what am I supposed to do? You're supposed to know. And then the other thing about the Lego games that always drives me crazy is the edges. Like, you fall off your edges, and they're a game about collecting, and you know that blue stud is worth, like, what is it, 1,000, you know, points, and they take one away every time you fall off. And so Harry Potter...
Oh, man, I gouge my eyes out whenever I see that explosion of studs.
Yep. I'm with you on there. Yes, the explosion of studs. I think.
Do you think the areas that are counterintuitive are because I've noticed some kids' games do this where there's like a they're gonna fuck up and do it factor. Like there's areas where they think that a kid is just gonna randomly do this spastic thing that will show them where they have to go next, which I thought was a fluke. And then I played a couple of kids' games and realized that the reason I couldn't get past certain parts is because I was overthinking it. Because then, like, a 6-year-old would sit down next to me and be like, oh, well, the stupid cool thing to do would be this. And that's, like, what you're supposed to do.
No, because there's certain points where I just, you know, annihilated and blew up everything and took it apart. And I just sat there like, what am I supposed to do next? Oh, and oh, you wanted me to go here. And like Jeremy said, there's nothing to really
show. There's just no indication.
You. No, okay. Perfect.
You're
dark
supposed
arrows
to go turn some crank that doesn't even look like a crank.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, wait, that looks like a bird because it's been Legoized. And then the other thing I think is you really almost have to play it with an adult. You need that kind of childlike mindset coupled with an adult mentality to surpass it. Because a kid will say, oh, that's a crank. Don't you see? It's like, oh, that is supposed to be? Okay. So. Play it with a kid.
Play it with a kid. Got it. That's, that could be construed incorrectly if that was like their tagline. Play it with a kid.
Mm. Play with an adult who's young at heart.
Yeah, there you go.
See, that Michael Jackson falls into that category too.
Oh, Sage. Why is it you this week?
Because it's been so long since I was around.
So you're so full of life and innuendo.
She's full of it, all right. The other thing, I played a little bit of Pinball Arcade, which I also for the Vita, a recreation of 4 tables, Black Hole, Tales of the Arabian Nights, Ripley's Believe It or Not, and Theater of Magic. Basically, the ball physics, and from what I can remember, the tables, the simulation of the machines is pretty top-notch. You can control the ball. You can do all the tricks you can, as you would with a real-world table. I think my only gripe is some of the stuff that's outside of play. Entering in your initials feels really laggy, and the game constantly wants you to connect to Wi-Fi, which means if you're not... you know, if you're not connected, there's like a 15-second waste of time between games as the game, you know, tries to connect. It brings up a list of signals, so on and so on. And I talked to I talked to the director of the game, and it sounds like they may patch some stuff, but still, if you're into pinball, definitely check it out. Four tables, $10. Crossplay between PS3 and Vita, which I think is really cool.
And or buy a real pinball machine, because some people sell them for cheap these days.
Yeah, but if you live in California, there's no space for them because you don't have a castle to live.
Do you not have a garage? I don't live in a castle. We had ours in a garage.
Yes, I have a garage that's filled with shit.
Well, fucking get rid of all the shit, man, and not then you'd have room for a pinball machine.
Not mine, it's my sister's.
You can't really bump up against the Vita, though. You know, if you're trying to tilt it or something, you can't really, like, get it in there and, you know, get some hip action going on. It doesn't really work the same way.
No, now, see, there's some innuendo right there, and that was not my doing.
Instead, you gotta touch the stick.
I'm just talking about pinball, you guys.
Sage.
Yeah.
Tell me about Diablo 3.
I will tell you about Diablo 3. Diablo 3 is cool. No.
Just cool.
Just cool. It's okay. No, it feels like Diablo 2 got a whole new bag.
Oh, okay.
There's like a wafting hint of Diablo 2 feeling still there, but they really have changed enough of the feel that almost it doesn't play like a Diablo game. It sort of feels still aesthetically like a Diablo game, but it doesn't quite play like a Diablo game. There's the only thing I'm really disappointed with, and really it's the only thing, is that they have gotten rid of your ability to sort of master your character. So when you level up, it distributes your attribute points for you. Into like intelligence, and that might just be because it's the beta and maybe they're not going to do that when they release it, I don't know. Right. But you level up and it tells you, you know, you have got 2 points into intelligence and one into this and blah, 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 blah. And then your skill trees, they exist and you can look at them, but you don't really get to pick what you get, because at certain levels it just gives you that thing for whatever tree would be appropriate for it. So like I'm playing the monk right now, because the cool thing is you can do these different classes, which are all cool, and you can pick a gender for them. So I'm a female monk. She's an expert at martial arts, so very appealing to me. And all of her strikes are really cool, and it's like, you know, power added to you gather spirit instead of mana when you attack people, and then you can use those powers to do other attacks. It's pretty cool that way. But anytime I get a skill, it just puts it into the next, like, okay, fist skill tree, or it puts it into the next, you know, kick skill tree. And it doesn't, there's no option for what you're going to pick. It just sort of gives it to you. At level 9, you're getting this. At level 12, you're getting this. And that's how it's
going to
be.
So you haven't distributed a single skill point then, is what you're saying?
Nope.
Yeah, haven't looked online? Maybe that's a quirk of the beta?
I'm saying it might be. I haven't checked for that because I've been busy just sort of playing it to get the feel for it. So it might just
like
be
leveling up your persona in Persona 3 Portable. It's like when you level up, the stats are automatically distributed, you know, just whatever way they choose to make.
I mean, I could see that for the stats, but skill. The whole appeal of Diablo is being able to build your kind of character with your abilities that you want. So something's kind of weird there. Sage is right. Either that's something for the beta, or it could be something with Sage.
I don't know. I don't know. For right now, it seems like that's because I've looked and there's nowhere where the skill trees branch out. There might be a moment where you get to actually pick to do. So like each skill section has like a thing of runes, and runes add like an extra bonus power to a skill you already have. But none of it is like branched out from each other. It's like these very direct lineage kind of like this kind of thing. So there's no, even if there is a moment like later on as you level up, or if they change that later on, if they keep this basic outlay of it, you still can't, even if you can pick different skills later, you still can't sort of invest how your tree looks, for lack of a better terminology there. Which I'm kind of disappointed about. It a little bit honestly feels like how Fable 2 and 3 made themselves stupid so that anybody could play them. Yeah. And it's like the point of especially since Diablo's a PC game, like the PC gaming
Dragon
world.
Dragon Age Origins too.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't think there's a reason to dumb down PC games, because most people who are PC gamers are PC gamers. Like, they, or let's say Mac/PC. Most people who are computer gamers are computer gamers. They know how to fucking play a game. So you don't really need to dumb it down for them, because the only new computer gamers that are getting on are 5-year-olds that probably know how to handle a computer and are probably going to be okay with sort of complex gameplay.
But even though Blizzard hasn't announced this for console, I'm sure it's going to head, it's going to head towards console.
Do you
and,
think?
Oh, I'm certain it's going to hit console.
So is that why it's stupid, do you think? Why they've made it, like, stupid proof?
You really want me to say it? Yes.
I do. That, see, okay, now that's disappointing. That was the kind of stuff that I was worried about, that they would do, that it would somehow become more, you know, for the common everyman, and less for, not that you have to keep it for Diablo fans, but you, but it should maintain some of that, like, integrity and complexity that it originally had. Anyway,
but wait, what is the problem with role-playing games where you have the game, you have that option where if you don't want to fiddle with it and you don't get off on messing with stats, to have the game automatically do it for you? And then for those players that want to tweak, you know, themselves in certain directions, to have that ability to micromanage.
Mm,
I played plenty of games
for it. I think you get over it, because it was never that complicated. Like, I could, because, like, like StarCraft is complicated. I mean, the micromanaging that goes on in something like StarCraft, you have to be really adept at that. But the micromanaging that you did in Diablo really just needed an investment in your character. And I think that this kind of switch takes away, because it was not complicated. I think it takes away from your ability to invest in your character. It's more like that conversation we had a couple of times ago about, it's more like you're watching a movie without really engaging, only you happen to be initiating the combat, but it's more like watching a movie about a character than actually being the character.
Yep.
Because the only thing I get to choose is what she's wearing and what I pick up off the ground. In that way, though, the mechanics are really clean. They made some changes that I like. Like, now, anything that lands on the ground, if you run near it, you'll pick it up. So health,
Wait, you just finished saying I get to choose what I pick up off the ground.
Anything that's not a... So, little health, like little bits of... It's not food, but little glowing red orbs that will up your health and gold automatically pick up. Everything else you have to choose to pick up. So items, like actual items, you still have to choose to pick up.
Wait, orbs for your health. There's no potions anymore?
No, there are still potions.
Okay.
So both will drop. If you have low health, if you don't have low health, they won't drop. Okay. If you have low health and you kill a bunch of monsters, you'll get little health orbs. But in addition to that, things like health potions will drop and items will drop. And those things you have to actually pick up. But that was a problem, I think, when you were partying with a bunch of people you didn't know and you're running through a dungeon. You killed a bunch of guys because you're the point guy. You know, you're the tank or whatever, and you're just barreling through things as the barbarian. And then you go back to get some gold and everyone else in your team has picked up all the gold. And you're like, fuck you, what the fuck? So this gets rid of that problem by making it so that, you know, you actually just pick gold up as you walk by it. That part's better. The graphics are great. I mean, so the monk does a lot of punching and kicking, and every time I do this, like, roundhouse kick, just demon body parts and blood go splattering across the landscape, nice. And it's gorgeous, and it makes me feel accomplished, and I'm so happy about it. So the graphics are great. They look a lot like Dungeon Siege, and more than they look like World of Warcraft, which I'm thrilled about, because I was worried it was going to look a lot like WoW. Which I don't really like that look that much.
Right.
So I was really happy when I saw that it looks more like Dungeon Siege, which is a Diablo clone. So, you know, it looks
great. A little bit more detailed.
More detailed, and the perspective is a lot more three-dimensional than Diablo 2, so that's good. The dungeons are now interactive, so, like, you walk into a room with bad guys, and if they're under a chandelier, or if you can lure them under a chandelier, you can cut the chandelier rope and it'll fall and crush them. That part's pretty cool, and it will give you bonus points to, like, bonus experience, and that part's really cool. The part that's a little less cool, that made me feel a little like they sold out,
are chandeliers and dungeons.
No, not that. That was fine. But that if you, there are certain things, like if you kill, like, you know, 20 bad guys in one explosion, right, you get a thing that's like achievement, you know, just like you get on the fucking Xbox or on, I mean, it's like they went that route of like, this is the popular thing to do, so let's add it into Diablo 3. So now this little thing will pop up that's like, you've got an achievement. And I'm like, I don't play Diablo for the chivos, man. I play it for the drops. That's not what I'm looking for.
Okay, now here I've got a question. There's one crucial point that you haven't gotten to, which is the loot, right? And you're talking about the graphics and the look. I want to know, if I pick up a piece of armor, does my character model change to look like that armor that I just picked up?
It, like in the close-up view or like in the
Like at all. Like, am I going to feel good for picking up that purple rare armor?
Yes. It's a little more cartoony, but yes. Like, if you have a vampiric blade, it has a red aura around it. If you have arcane
fangs on it.
No. But it is, like, fangy looking as a blade. If you, like, right now I'm an arcane vampiric monk, because I've got arcane stuff and vampiric stuff. Arcane stuff
has... Just like real life.
A purple glow. Yes, just like real life. I'm glad that you know.
Widow's Peak?
Yes. Exactly. No. And you do wear different things. What I do think is hilarious is apparently from the beginning I was wearing underwear and no pants, because as soon as I picked up a pair of shorts, and they're like little booty shorts, they're like the little booty shorts of regeneration or something, and as soon as I put them on, it was like I was wearing shorts. Before that, apparently I wasn't wearing anything, because there was nothing. There was just nothing, and then I put the shorts on and there were shorts. Which I thought was interesting. I feel like I should have had pants on.
I think you should try to finish the game nude.
I don't want to finish the game nude. I feel like that's a mistake.
there's probably an achievement in that.
But yes, anyway, so it looks good. Oh, the only other major thing, which I don't think is just me having researched it, mine is really choppy. But it's only choppy when I first get to a new area, because once I've been in the area for a while and, like, have gone to places, like, when I go back to those places, it's not choppy. So it's not my internet connection, and I checked all my specs against their min spec requirements. My processor is just under what they ask for. So I went online to research it to see if that was what was screwing it up, because it's pretty close. I mean, I basically have the same processor, but... A lot of people, well, not a lot, there's apparently a percentage of beta testers who are having this problem. So if you're a beta tester and you're listening to this and you are having this, like, choppy, laggy experience, some people are just getting that, and there seems to have not been a fix or a patch initiated for it, because they're focusing on the release in a month.
Mm-hmm. So if you're a beta tester and you're below the minimum spec and you're getting a choppy
some people some people
hit the forums
have,
and blame Blizzard.
No, some people have, like, above spec are still getting the chop. Like, some people are just getting choppy, and it seems to have nothing to do with, and some people have even switched over to, like, an SSD drive to try and fix it. There's a lot of forums about it, and for some people that works, and for some people they're still getting the chop. So it seems like some people, no matter what your spec system is, even if it's above par, and even if you, like, downgrade to lower graphics and all these other fixes, some people are just getting choppy frame rate, and they don't seem to have a good... It's like a small percentage just somehow got the ghost in the shell on their version, and it's just choppy.
You just threw in that PC anime gaming title.
What?
You just threw in ghost in the shell.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like a mixed anime metaphor there. That was actually pretty impressive.
Very nice.
Mind blown.
I'm glad I blew your mind. The other thing that I've been playing, unless you guys have any other D3 questions. No?
No.
Okay. The other thing, I have been playing one other thing, which I can't talk about, but that's coming soon, so stay tuned. Stay tuned for future deliciousness. But the other thing I've been playing that I can talk about is Skullgirls. I got it on Xbox Live Arcade.
Yes. Awesome. Tell us about Skullgirls.
It's delightful. I have been intrigued by it from the beginning. I love the in-depth storyline for everything. I love how they pull all these references to pop culture things that are actually somewhat obscure. They have, like, a feline-based character, and she makes a pun about clawed encounters of the furred kind, which was a pun from Bubsy.
Yes!
Way back in the day. So they pull it from there, right? And, right? So my love of Bubsy shows up everywhere.
Wow. I've got to look. Who made this?
Wrong.
They've got a Jessica Rabbit quote, but they've modified it a little. So the one character says to the other character, "You're not bad. You're just drawn that way." And they reference like paintings, and like they'll have some characters sitting in, you know, the classic, I forget the name of it, the cafe painting. The like late night cafe painting with the people sitting inside at the diner bar.
Oh, right. The dead stars.
I saw the version of that with the Muppets, I think.
Well, right. Everybody uses that, but they use that for, you know, they've modified it, of course, but they use that for one scene. So it's really cool. The backstories are really in depth. On a comparison to something like Soul Calibur, it's right up there. Like, in fact, on that level, the backgrounds of the characters are even more in-depth. Like, you get a really good sense of who these people are and why they're fighting for this thing. In Soul Calibur, you're all fighting for the sword, but you don't really know why. It's just because it's there and you're going to, and maybe they sort of have a reason occasionally, but most of them are just, they want to get it.
Or in the last game, you have these brothers and sisters who... their story is completely removed from everybody else, and right. It's told through flat drawings that look like they were drawn by an 8-year-old.
Right. No, but this is great.
That's cool. So the single player, I think our readers were kind of concerned about that. So the single player really hits it.
As
far as backstory. Characterization.
Yeah, as far as that stuff goes, it's totally great. The opening has this great steampunk noir feel to it, with just enough anime sort of animation and feel to appeal to the otaku. Just enough, though. It doesn't overdo it. Like, people who don't like anime would not be turned off. People who do like anime would catch little, oh, it's almost a little bit sort of like Cowboy Bebop in some ways, and really be into it. It's super
cool.
People
who would not like anime, not like Cowboy Bebop. I mean, Cowboy Bebop is Cowboy Bebop.
Yeah, but not everyone likes that animation style. But this is an anime animation style, so it's fine. They all have unique stories. There's not a lot of empty holes. They're very... And each opening, if you're playing story mode, each character's opening is completely, completely different. There's no, like, overlap other than them fighting. The one thing I will say is the controls are not as intuitive as you would think. You'd think it's a fighting game, right? You'd think fighting game, the controls are going to be intuitive and all over, and you're going to know them. But it's like the combo controls are not. I mean, the typical punch-kick buttons are the same, but the combo controls are not what you would think they would be. So I hit XXY and I do nothing. And then when you go into story mode, it pairs you against someone who apparently this character has been playing the game for 30 years because they're like throwing combos out that are just kicking your ass. So the first like 10 rounds that I've played, I've gotten my ass handed to me because I don't really... I mean, I could go into arcade mode and like sit there and look at the control menus and everything, but I like to play with it, try and get a sense of it first.
Are you blocking?
I am blocking people.
Are you using an arcade stick?
No, I am not using an arcade stick. Maybe that is my problem.
If you're using the crappy-ass 360 D-pad, that's definitely going to be a problem.
No, it's not, because it's a tiny joystick. It's a stick. It's just small. It's small, but it still works.
Well,
The directional pad on the 360? That's the worst thing known to man.
Not the D-pad, the joystick one. You can use the...
I said the D-pad.
Who uses the analog to play a fighting game?
Me, goddammit.
No wonder why you got problems.
Dude, fucking shut up. If you want to play Soul
Calibur,
you can
get stick extenders for those, too. I mean, I don't know from personal experience, but those extenders, I hear they work.
No, when I play Soul Calibur, like, I rip ass as Tallum, and I always use the analog stick. And that's not the problem. The problem is that, like, you know, in Soul Calibur, XXY does something substantial. And in this game...
I'm just saying the reaction time when you have a directional pad is just a tap. But when you have an analog, the throw of the analog stick, it takes much longer.
By what, 0.2 seconds or something?
Those 0.2 seconds can make all the difference.
Okay, yeah, I will switch to that lag for you guys, but I'm pretty sure that that's not what's going to make the difference.
Ask how many pros. Go to Evo. See how many people are playing with the analog stick.
I will find out.
Zero. I'll tell you right now.
Justin Wong. Ask Justin.
What about Justin Wong?
He's like the god of Street Fighter or something like that.
Is he?
I believe so. I might have gotten thrown out at a tournament or something like that. Maybe. I don't know. I don't keep up with the tournament scene.
So, Sage, here's the other question, Sage. Uh-huh. So, we have Skullgirls now. Do we still need Darksiders? I mean, everybody's been asking for Darksiders, but it seems to me like this might fill that niche, right?
Well, you have to like a game that's all girls, for one.
I sure do.
Arcana Hearts.
From Roses?
What?
Rumble Roses.
Rumble Roses?
Yes. All girl wrestling.
Come on. That was that's been like the last 5 years. You have to know what Rumble Roses is.
Right. No, I do know.
Best wrestling game besides WWE 12 of ever. This generation.
I don't play a lot of wrestling games, Blue. I'm not as into them as you are.
Yeah,
I wrestle people in real life. I don't really want to do it with my video games.
You wrestle people in real life?
Yes.
Do you tour?
No. Home field kind of.
Okay, faces and heels. Let's move on. Jeremy,
I want to make sure I answer your question. I think that they both fulfill something different. I don't think that this takes the place. So I think you would be happy getting both and playing both. I don't think that they're compatible that way, comparable that way.
Which other game?
Darksiders.
Darkstalkers?
Darkstalkers. I'm sorry. Why did I say Darksiders? You're right. Darksiders.
Darksiders. Zelda.
Those two throw me too.
Yes, it is.
I knew what you meant.
Darksiders? Yeah, thank you.
I think you might have, but somebody. I knew what you meant.
I got to correct you because I make those mistakes every 2 minutes. You guys know. Okay, so Jeremy.
Style is totally different. Well, not totally, but it's pretty damn different.
Yes.
And one's about vampires, and one's about a plethora of weird little girls. So.
Not just vampires.
Well, no, but.
There's a mummy.
There's a mummy. There are a lot of vampires, though, and this is a lot of weird people.
What about John Talbot? He's a werewolf. Jeremy, which is quite.
All right, well, kind of going back to Sage's discussion about RPGs that are kind of getting a little bit more streamlined, you know, not allowing you to do your own customizations and things like that. I've been playing a lot of Final Fantasy XIII, too. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds like a slam against it, but I have to say, I actually was one of the few people who really enjoyed Final Fantasy XIII. I don't know what the score was here, if you guys really liked that or not.
I did.
Did you?
I think, Blue, did you play it?
Nah, I messed around with the demo for a couple of minutes, didn't know what was going on, so I'm like, fuck it.
Well, I did.
Really? Well, the thing about Final Fantasy XIII, in my opinion, is that I think Final Fantasy XIII, the first one was sort of a real nexus of some of the different directions that the video game industry is going, especially with streamlining and trying to make things a little less complicated. And I think that may have been successful in some ways and maybe less successful in others. A lot of people like the combat system, for example, and one of the things that the combat system really did, and this carries over into 13.2, is it takes away a lot of the micromanagement. I mean, obviously the idea in the game is to come up with your paradigms, your different classes that your characters can be. And you sort of give them the broad strokes. You say, okay, I want you to be on defense. I want you to be a magic user. And it will automatically, the characters will sort of figure out the best individual attacks for those kinds of things. And so it was successful in that way. It may have been less successful in the way that it streamlined the overworld, I guess you might call it, the corridors that everybody talked about, the hallways. Sure. But that was kind of the same thing. I mean, as you were playing that game, you were always progressing toward the end. You weren't doing a lot of wandering around. And some people like that. Some people didn't. I actually found it to be really refreshing because I don't like to go off on a lot of side tangents and end up playing a game for 120 hours. I don't have that kind of time anymore. Also, the leveling system, the Crystarium, was a way of trying to simplify, I think, some of the leveling factors. And they took for Final Fantasy XIII, too, a lot of the ideas that were successful, and they maybe made some small changes here and there, but I think they took, I think everybody's heard at this point that they took a lot of the feedback that they got on Final Fantasy XIII and tried to improve on it. Mm-hmm. So the combat remains largely intact. You only really have two characters this time. There's a character named Noel. And then you play Sarah, who was Lightning's little sister, I guess, from the original game, and you still have the paradigm shifts, and you still have the classes like from before, and this time they've actually done a few minor tweaks to that. Before in Final Fantasy XIII, for example, if you chose to be an all commando party, meaning it didn't have anything to do with their clothing or anything, but if they were, yeah, if you decided to be that you were going to be the brawlers, right? You wanted to be the people who dealt damage. Well, the problem was that your characters would not attack the same target, and if you really wanted to focus that, it kind of slowed things down a little bit. And so here they've given you the choice not only to have the paradigms, but to kind of tweak that a little bit and to say, well, we want to go commando, but we all want to attack, the same target, for example. And they've introduced now the mechanic where you can sort of tame creatures, for example. The first time time you defeat an enemy, that becomes a character that you can then incorporate into your party, and you can then start leveling up that character.
Like Legend of the Seven thing. Stars?
Yeah.
Is it sort of like Mario Legend of the Seven Stars?
Same kind of idea. And that's one of the things that makes, I think, video games really fun is, you know, as far back as you can go, if you can get the bad guys on your team, like, how awesome is that? Like, if you can defeat some awesome guy and then now you can turn that around and he's on your team, it's sweet. And so that's kind of a neat little idea. But the leveling for that, you know, I think...
But it always drove me nuts in Pokemon where you couldn't take the other... Monster, what was it? Monster trainers, bad guys. You couldn't steal them.
It's make way of Pokeball before they would get to the monster or whatever.
No, you should really be able to.
Yeah, snag them.
You should be. You know what? You forget the freaking Pokemon. Just throw down and beat the crap out of the kid. Is what.
I was wondering why they never did that. We have a problem, so we're gonna settle it with our Pokemans.
You know what? They just live in a utopia, perfect world. So, Final Fantasy 13 2, then, you know, they've also, like, this is a really subtle thing. I haven't seen anybody really talk about this, but one of the things that I have kind of liked, because even though I like 13, you know, obviously there's some pretty grown-worthy dialogue, right? They'll start talking about their, you know, we'll find the truth if we look into our hearts, or, you know, whatever it is, and you're like, ah, okay, you know, right.
Anything as bad as the, trying to laugh segment from Final Fantasy X.
No, I think that's probably about the pinnacle of right there. But every once in a while you'll have an opportunity in Final Fantasy 13-2 to choose your own dialogue, and I've kind of found that. You know, in situation, like, you can almost pick. They give you four choices to pick, and someone tells you about, you know, this game's all about time travel, so you're trying to figure out what's causing these little rifts in time, and you can pick a dialogue option, and I've found that it's really nice to just get straight to the point, and I can almost pick out the other dialogue options that, if they hadn't given me those choices, the Japanese developers probably would have picked some obtuse discussion, and I wouldn't have been able to get anything out of it, and I just would have hated it. But now I can be like, you know, what's up with time rifts? And they'll tell me all about their time rifts or whatever. And you know, there's, like I said, even some of the stuff that I didn't really like the battles now, when you engage in a battle, in the original game, you would sort of see in the overworld, you'd see the characters coming up and you would try and get behind them, which was how you would get initiative in a battle. Now they sort of pop out of nowhere, and they have something called a Mog clock. It's this Moogle that travels with you, and it's kind of on a timer, where if you strike the enemy before a certain point, you can have initiative or not. Mm-hmm. But I kind of figured out that they can kind of start doing some interesting things with different kinds of encounters. And so even the stuff, basically the kind of the bottom line on this is that I've been finding that the changes they've made really, I think, over time, you know, or with feedback from the previous game, I think they've done a really good job, and I'm actually really looking forward. I haven't finished it yet. I'm probably only about a dozen hours in, 15 hours in maybe, but I've really enjoyed what I've played of it so far, and you know, it's been on sale recently, so you can get it for, I think, $30 at Amazon or maybe even Best Buy. There may even be some coupons out there that you can get, and I definitely think, especially if you skip the first Final Fantasy 13, I would at least check into it, you know, maybe give it a rental or something, but I think the 13 series, the fabulous Christova Novalis or whatever they call it, I think it's kind of gotten a little bit of a bad rap.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend that. It's been good.
Any Bubsy references?
You know, there may have been a little bit of Pantsu going on, but here's the thing. Here's something they've been doing a little differently now, is they've been doing a lot of DLC for 13-2.
Yeah.
A lot of costumes. You can get, you know, beach outfits, and they just this last week released Assassin's Creed outfit for Noel. I mean, they've been doing a lot of cross-branding sorts of things, and I have to admit, I've been, you know, queuing up the beach wear, and, you know, it's not bad.
Oh. Tell me about your journey to hell. That's what I'm really looking for.
Army Corps of Hell, Vita. Yeah, again, another Square Enix game. And again, another one that kind of gets a little bit of a bad rap. I don't like it as much, though. This is one where I would say that I don't know that I could really recommend this as a full-price purchase. But the idea behind Army Corps of Hell, if you've ever played Pikmin, which I know a lot of people have, but I'm often... kind of surprised to find that several people haven't. Overlord, the Overlord games on PC and console, where you control kind of an Overlord character or a demonic force, in this case kind of a skull sort of dude, skeleton, hellish guy, and you accumulate these little minions, these little goblin guys, and you can eventually through the course of the game, just like Pikmin or just like Overlord, you start to get special powers for them, different kinds of guys. Some of them are fighters who will sort of swarm larger enemies, and you can do a little mini game to destroy them, or spearmen who will go on a straight long shot across the map. Mm-hmm. Magicians who kind of have a little power-up shot that will spread out and kill a bunch of guys. But the scope of this game really is, I think, a lot more limited. Whereas something like Pikmin was a lot about exploration. I mean, is Pikmin not one of the greatest games of all time, really?
Definitely one of the best in the GameCube.
It is not.
It is not.
Sorry. Oh,
we have some doubters.
Yeah, I like the game, but I was not as wild and crazy about it as most people. I don't know.
Well, your loss, right. I guess. Yeah. And even Overlord.
I guess it's a console RTS. It's satisfactory, but I really can't put it beyond that.
I don't know. I think you're looking at it wrong if you're thinking of it as an RTS. I mean, it's a little bit more about having a reach. You know, your character can throw out. I mean, and it's the same for all of these games. You know, whether it's Pikmin or Overlord or Army Corps of Hell. You have this certain sphere of influence, this certain area of effect, mm-hmm. and you can. It's very puzzly. You know, I mean, even in Pikmin, you had fire guys and you know heavy guys in Pikmin 2, and you'd use them to different effects. And the same thing is true here in Army Corps of Hell, and it works out all right. And you know, it's not really the best looking game on the Vita, mm-hmm. you know, is another kind of
sure
it has. But then the other thing about it is they really break it up. Whereas you had kind of some open spaces in Pikmin or in Overlord, in Army Corps of Hell, you sort of travel between these little islands. Mm-hmm. You know, you have these little jetways that go from one island to the next. And each of the little islands is kind of like a puzzle. You might have different mixes of enemies there, some where you have to use different goblins, different minions to try and make the most of your group. Or they might have little barriers, little electric barriers that will fry your guys. And as you lose them, you know, you have a chance to revive them. But part of the idea is that you're doing this for a score as well. And but I think overall, I mean, the scope of it is a lot more. I mean, it just feels a lot more cramped. You know, it's mm-hmm. like you're going from this one to that one. And if you're into that, I mean, if you like that idea of conquering little puzzles on your way to, you know, a boss character or something like that, you might really like it. And definitely some value there to it. And there's lots of upgrades and you know, different little effects that you can get by giving the guys little, hats or things. We'll give mm-hmm. them different stat boosts and things. And it's not bad, but it's not really great. I mean, if someone was asking me, should I spend it might be $30. Should I spend that money? There's a lot of good stuff on the Vita that you could probably spend that money on mm-hmm. elsewhere.
I have a weird question. I think that my main problem with Pikmin, at least the first game, was the timer. I didn't think it needed the timer. Is there one in Army Corps of Hell?
No, there's no timer, but you get a different score depending on how quickly you beat the levels.
Okay, fair enough.
And I think that's kind of, you know, the age-old question about video games. I mean, you know, oh my God, Super Mario Brothers, I've got 300 seconds to beat this. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I know it was liberating when Super Mario 2 came around and you could just kind of, you know, putz around as much as you wanted. But I think on some level, and I understand there can be some stress associated with that, but mm-hmm. on the other hand, if you take away some of those constraints, is it really as much fun?
Right. Maybe that was my issue with Pikmin, because I thought that the game really didn't need that. And I thought it was kind of had this laid-back, I don't know, vibe that where the timer seemed to go against the other mechanics in the game, where it didn't allow me to really enjoy. I constantly felt pressured.
Yeah.
Really? You got stressed out by Pikmin, all those little flowers?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
it's the sort of thing where
you're in this beautiful backyard, you know, it's the beauty and virtue of nature laid out before you. And here's a timer because you can't admire it. So you can't really have fun.
Now, when you say the timer, are you talking about the day, you know, the day to night timer, or the fact that you only have 30 days to complete the game, otherwise your air runs out and you lose? That was what pissed me off.
Both of those.
Wow.
I mean, Robert, I can understand the day. I can understand the day timer. You know, sunrise to sundown or whatever. But only having like 30 days to accomplish it, that was what really pissed me off, because like my first save ended up, I think my Olimar ended up a Pikmin or something, yep. Like, or something like that.
It's well, just like having a 1,000 Brini.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the point of that? It's already, well, with Prinny, it's already a hard game. But what is, you know, yeah. What does that do? What purpose does that serve?
Yeah. But anyway, you know, the vibe, I think, of all of these games. Yeah, that, I mean, that's one thing that I really liked. I mean, in Pikmin, I really liked the, you know, the flavor of the game. I liked the way that it was kind of cute. And there was a little Piklopedia that you could use to find out, gosh, what's this, you know, what's this carrot, or what, you know, what's this other thing. In Overlord, I really liked the irreverent humor of the little minions. And in Army Corps of Hell, they actually go for a full on. I mean, I guess it's kind of ironic in sort of a post Brutal Legend kind of era. But it's like full on, like, legit, you know, heavy metal music. It's like, raw, 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 raw. You know, I mean, it's like the real, and so it's kind of like, haha, you know, they go for the metal, and it kind of works for me that way too. Like, I kind of dig that vibe where, you know, it's kind of jokey, but it's kind of, you know, like, hey, here's some really awesome metal. It's all, I think it's all Japanese metal though. I think they got it from Japan, yeah. But it, you know, it still sounds good.
I love Japanese metal.
I'm pretty sure there's a demo. I could be wrong about that. Anyway, for me, it does work.
I don't
but...
think there is a demo. Because that is the one Vita game I haven't played yet.
Is that right? Yeah. Like I said, it works for me, but I don't know if it works for me at full price.
Right. I've always been curious about it, though.
Apart from that, I have a few other things that we've been playing here, and I don't want to monopolize too much time here, especially as the new guy. Like, who the hell is this? But Robert, you and I played a little bit of SOCOM, SOCOM 4 the other night. We sort of poured one out in honor of Zipper Interactive, who has gone their course, unfortunately. And, you know, we threw a few invitations out on Twitter and nobody showed up. And I don't want to say that that's us. You know, we had a good time ourselves, and I'm sure that people really would like to play with us. But I found it kind of telling. I mean, we were talking a little bit as we played the game, like how popular, you know, can your game be before, you know, you're just no longer profitable, before you have to be shut down.
Right.
And if you look at their last few games, I mean, they, you know, they did before this, it was MAG. Most recently, Unit 13 has just come out. And and as much as, I mean, I like it, I like the idea of it, but is it really making a big splash? Not really. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, it was all the, you know, the PSP, Fireteam Bravo, and Navy SEALs games on the PlayStation 2. And I don't know. I mean, to me, SOCOM seems like it has a really dedicated group, and maybe even a large group of people. But I just don't know how many people are actually buying their games.
Mm-hmm. So. I just associate the SOCOM franchise with PlayStation, and for them to kind of, I'm not sure if Sony still has the rights to it, or Zipper. You know, I don't. It's going to die with Zipper, but it just seems kind of weird for them to get rid of Zipper. You know, they were a competent developer. Like you said, seem to have a real, you know, cultish following.
I don't think you can. I think that some companies try to get the one up on, because of all of those sort of combat oriented team games.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where a lot of fanboyism comes from, because people seem to get into, well, I play Call of Duty, well, I play SOCOM, or I play, you know, and right. They get really into it and they never really switch. And I think that sometimes companies decide they want to try and get the one up over other companies. And so they decide, like, oh, if we bring in new people, that'll, but I think they're wasting their time, because people just sort of pick the one that they want to play, and then they never really change from that one.
It is a crowded genre, and you know, they kind of did that the entire time. I mean, just looking through the list of other games that they did, I mean, and since 2000, you know, I guess they worked on Crimson Skies for Microsoft, MechWarrior, which was good. I didn't realize they'd worked on MechWarrior 3, but it's been tactical shooters ever since then. And is that really a growth market? It's kind of hard to say it is.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay.
But, you know, we'll miss them, and you know, we have a lot of good times playing SOCOM. So if anyone's out there wants to play some SOCOM 4, I know the Deagle's up for it. You know,
always.
He's a big fat target, so, you know, come on down. And, yeah.
What are you talking about? Who beat you last time? Tell the truth
about,
now.
He's talking about your ass, Robert.
Yes, my ass is a target. Yeah. That's why I paint a bullseye on it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a couple other things, but like I said, I know I've already... kind of taken some time here. Was there anything on there, Deagle, that you looked at that you wanted to talk about a little?
A little bit about Fez, honestly.
Yeah, I did play Little Fez. Fez came out, I don't know when the podcast will be released, but it came out just this week on Xbox Live Arcade. Of course, that is the sort of retro nouveau platformer from Polygon and Phil Fish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have to say it was a little tough to get through the expletive-filled tirade against Japanese games right there at the beginning, but once you power through that, you know...
Wait, it's actually in the game? It's on the loading screen?
Oh, yeah. It's like, yeah, it's an option, you know. You just hit start, and they suck.
I'm surprised it would have been, they didn't include it as DLC or something. Yeah. People would pay good money for that.
Well, as though... Fez is, I mean, everybody is just, they're loving it. All of the indie cred people on the internet and Twitter are you know, and it is really charming. I mean, it is a really neat idea. I mean, it's you've probably seen the videos by now. This thing has been in development for, you know, 10 years or however long. Yeah, just a long time. And I have to say, to compare it to something, did any of you play, I don't know how many of you play PSP Minis or PS Minis, but did anybody ever see or play the game from a few months ago, Where Is My Heart?
Sean did.
Yeah, Where Is My Heart is kind of the idea is that you kind of have a broken world and you can sort of you know, jump in midair and rearrange the world and kind of come back down. Fez has kind of that same sort of thing, and the idea behind Fez is that you know, everybody in this 2D retro world you know, kind of doesn't realize that there is a third dimension, and so Gomez, you know, the it seems like we were talking about
Adam's Family.
About the Adam's Family. It's all coming back around. So Gomez is this little white pixely guy, and he is given a gift to be able to see the third dimension, and it kind of does the same thing that you can do 2D platforming, but then you can hit the left or right triggers or bumpers, you can do either, and rearrange the world kind of in you know, mid jump, or you know, kind of see what's going on behind the scenes. And I have to admit, I was a little bit skeptical that I would enjoy it or that I would really find it all that charming, but I think it has it's getting to me a little bit. So I haven't played very much of it, but I think everybody who spent time with it can agree that it looks like it's going to be something special, and I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about it here in the future. So.
Sounds like the interactive version of Plato's Allegory of the Cave. I lost all our listeners.
No. We're assuming that there is an ideal out there somewhere that we cannot see or perceive, and if you ask the indie gaming community and press, it's Fez. So.
Well, no, the shadows on the wall, the three dimension.
That's true. Okay. All right. There are the shadows that we can perceive.
Yes. So, speaking of perception, why don't we take a break right now and talk about pinball with Bobby King. Woo! Farsight Studios is going to talk about the pinball arcade. Hey guys, Desert Eagle here with Farsight Studios' Bobby King, who serves as the Director of Development for the Pinball Arcade. Thanks for coming on the show, Bobby.
Hey, thanks, Robert. It's a pleasure being on your show.
Yeah. Now, Farsight is definitely a veteran studio with a legacy dating back to the 16-bit era. Could you tell me a little bit about your company's formation and perhaps offer up some details of early work?
Sure. Farsight started over 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was 1989. Jay Obernolte, who's the president and founder of Farsight, started it in his dorm room at Caltech. Mm. And he started doing educational software, actually these, you know, small little Apple II games, you know, edutainment games that would go with textbooks.
Yes.
And that led into doing some console work for the NES.
Mm-hmm.
And the first two games were Color Dinosaur and Art Alive. And that eventually led to doing a sports game.
Right.
David Crane's Amazing Tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And that started what Farsight's bread and butter was for many years, which was doing sports games. So for Sega, first party, Farsight made NFL 95, 96, and 98.
Mm-hmm.
98 outsold Madden that year on Genesis.
Wow. And was one of those the one with Deion Sanders?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was.
I played that.
I'm
dating myself.
I'm sure I'll be dating myself when we talk about pinball tables and what I grew up with.
We both will. Longtime readers may recall playing the Gottlieb and Williams collections, which premiered for the PS2, the GameCube, and the Xbox. Now, how did Farsight make the jump from a lot of these sports games into kind of the pinball arena?
Okay, so we made a game called ESPN NFL Primetime for Konami.
Okay.
That came out in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
It was NFL, and ESPN NFL Primetime 2002. So in early 2002, the NFL took the license away from several companies due to pressure from EA.
Right.
And two of those companies were Acclaim and Konami.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our one gig. Mm. We were a one product at a time studio back then. And we lost our game. We were working on the sequel, and we got word that Konami had canceled it. They tried for like a month to convince the parent company that they should go on with an unlicensed version that would be based on the players, but that didn't take. So what we did is we created a spec game called Mojo.
Hmm.
Which was an action puzzle game with a ball rolling around and changing different colors and breaking blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out, we made like one world. It was like 11 levels and went out and tried to sell it. People loved it. We went to at least 10, 15 publishers and the response was overwhelmingly positive.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was an action puzzle game doesn't project well for sales because there's like nothing out there.
Right.
So nobody wanted to pick it up. So the company Crave Entertainment, who was getting heavily into doing casual games, mass market, value titles.
Yes.
They loved it, and they saw a perfect place for it. At 1995, they had great presence at retail.
Right.
So they published it. We had to crank out like 90 more levels really fast.
Right.
I designed all the levels on it. So it went from 11 levels to 100 levels in like a month. So we had really big plans for that game, and we still do. We want to bring it back out, especially now that you've got, phones and tablets and accelerometers, and it's a perfect game for rolling a ball around.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah.
So is that an official announcement, Mojo 2? iPhone, Android? unofficial?
I can make an official announcement that it will be coming back.
Okay.
Probably going to rename it
something
else and make it a little bit bigger.
Right.
One thing that was really popular back then was the being able to create a level.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to make a big user active community in creating levels and designing them and sharing them.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, that game did fairly well. It did all right. But what Crave really wanted, because of this mass market casual value space, was a pinball game. And the first thing that they asked for was for us to design some tables and give them a pinball game.
Mm-hmm.
And being pinball players ourselves, and knowing and seeing what other games were out there, whether pinball games were out there, and how the real pinball tables kind of blow them away when it comes to depth and gameplay, we preferred to go out and try to license actual tables.
Sure.
So we went to the Pinball Hall of Fame, which was actually wasn't at the Pinball Hall of Fame yet. This is in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Arnold was founding it. And we talked to him, and he said Gottlieb would probably be the easiest one to go out and get. So that's where we started. We started with the Gottlieb collection. We did 11 tables,
mm-hmm.
and it sold really well.
Now, I had one question. Considering that I know Williams and both Gottlieb are kind of shadows of their former entities, I know that Williams is now, what, WMS, and they make kind of these gambling machines.
Right.
How difficult is it to wrangle the rights for some of the tables now?
Well, we have different agreements with each of the manufacturers. Our mm-hmm. agreements with Gottlieb. Gottlieb is owned primarily by like a law firm, you know, that represents the Gottlieb name, and
mm-hmm.
they're kind of hands off when it comes to picking tables. There's no approval process. That's very simple.
Mm.
There's a lot of people still at WMS
mm-hmm.
from the Williams and Bally days who are big pinball guys.
Mm.
Roger Sharp being one of the foremost, you know, names in pinball.
Mm-hmm.
Having saved the pinball back in the 70s from being, you know, outlawed as gambling.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He's there and he has approvals on all of our tables. So so that's Williams and Bally and then Stern.
Mm-hmm. Like Stern
is currently, you know, on the upswing. I mean, they're coming back. They've got a lot of the greatest guys ever, you know, working there.
Yeah.
And so they're being very critical and in the approval process, and mm-hmm. so that's the manufacturer licenses.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I should probably mention is that the Stern license includes, because Stern owns it, all of the Data East and Sega tables.
Mm. Okay.
We haven't done one yet, but we have plans to.
Mm.
So then, in addition to the manufacturer licenses, there's lots of tables, especially if you look at like the top, you know, 50 of all time, that include an ancillary license.
Yeah,
at least one.
I could imagine something like the Addams Family with all the music and the actors.
Yeah, so I can tell you about the Addams Family, because that's, as I've said, it's the holy grail of pinball licenses.
Right.
It's the best selling pinball table of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that table, we need rights from the Addams Foundation. We have Paramount, who did the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The table's based on the movies. And all the actors.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the actors has passed away, Raul Julia, and mm-hmm. his estate is very reluctant to give the license.
Mm.
And the music to the table was from the movie, not owned by Paramount, not owned by the Addams Family or Williams.
MC Hammer, right?
MC Hammer.
Yeah.
So we need the Hammer license. or at least we need to get his, you know, his agreement to let us use it.
Right.
So if you add up all of those licenses, because everyone wants, most licensors want some part of the back end,
mm-hmm.
It's going to be difficult.
Yes. But
there's so much demand for that table
mm-hmm.
that we're still hopeful that we can get it done.
Hmm.
You know, other tables, for example, we've announced that we're going to be doing Monster Bash and mm-hmm. Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Creature has some songs, actually 5 licensed songs in it that we'll be trying to get the license for. And so that adds a little bit. But Monster Bash is just, you know, Universal Studios, Universal Pictures, Frankenstein, Dracula. And that was simply us going to Universal and getting a license for
mm-hmm.
Making those monsters.
Did that one have the mummy, too?
Yep.
Yeah, the mummy, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now one thing, in the process of, say, recreating some of the tables like you did for the Williams Gottlieb, what do you guys use as a point of reference? Do you actually purchase a machine?
Yeah, well, let me give you some history there.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we, you know, go back to the Gottlieb collection, we could only pick tables that they had up and running at the Pinball Hall of Fame,
mm-hmm.
and the Pinball Hall of Fame wasn't even existing yet. So these are tables that Tim Arnold had in his backyard in an airplane hangar that were up and running and working well.
Mm.
And what we did is we had to take photo reference.
Mm-hmm.
We had to take We had to record audio from a microphone, and we had to take very diligent gameplay notes with a video recorder at the same time, and then our programmers would have to go and recode all the rules, which was extremely tedious, and as you might imagine, it's, I mean, if you've seen a pinball machine and the way that the inserts on the playfield, the lights,
sure,
they work. I mean, they're very specific and they're very fast, and getting that to be recreated perfectly, reprogramming it is a
nightmare.
It's a big, yeah, it's a nightmare. Yeah. I mean, it's nothing when I get perfect. And then you talked about modern machines where the Dotmation display is a whole other thing. Like we did Teed Off in the Gottlieb collection. And so our Dotmation display there was kind of hacked. I mean, we did an all right job, but it's basically a series of different, you know, bitmaps that, you know, one comes over the other at the right times. Where now with ROM emulation, we can, you know, pixel for pixel, just have it be perfect. So then the Williams collection came out, and we did the same thing. We could only pick the tables that they had there up and running. And there was one day, I mean, usually you can't all do this all in one trip to Vegas. We had to make a trip back, and it was like summer. I remember it was like 115, 120 degrees in this airplane hangar in Vegas. I mean, it was unbelievably, like, it was an endurance test of heat. So that, I mean, that was the old days. And then we came out with a improved Williams collection that included Medieval Madness, Tales of the Arabian Nights, and No Good Gophers. And those three tables are ROM emulated. So starting like midway through the Williams collection, we went out and we bought all the tables. So we started improving the sound. We would record the sound. Even if we weren't ROM emulating it, we'd record the sound right off of the board that's in the machine. And then for the ROM emulator tables, all the rule sets, all the light sequencing, the DMD, that's just pure ROM emulation. Similar to something called MAME, which is out there on the PC.
Yeah. Because for the Williams, you have some of those really distinctive sounds that sound right out of Defender. That kind of vibrato little tone in there that you really hear. Now, I had one question. I know new pinball machines have this, you know, kind of stiff feel to them, and older machines have this kind of worn-in feeling where they don't have the same amount of snap. What do you guys aim for?
We aim for recreating a table when it was new.
Okay.
However, to your point, the amount of energy transferred off of the flippers and off of the slingshots and pop bumpers, or jet bumpers in Williams terms, was a lot less back in the day, even when they were brand new.
Yeah.
You know, Stern recently, like as of the last like 4 years, they've put a ton of energy into the slingshots and stuff. So hopefully when we're able to get some of those licenses and do some of the newer Stern tables, we'll be increasing that amount of energy. But so I guess what I'm trying to say is that while the old tables feel like broken in and a little slower, what we try to do is what those tables would have played like when they're new.
Right.
And so
the electromechanical tables.
And even the early, you know, solid state machines.
Okay.
We want to have them play like when they were new. I mean, so, if you talk about a table like high speed, like in 1985, that table played really fast. I mean, that's a classic Steve Ritchie table that really changed the way the games were designed, and things started going a lot faster. The gameplay was faster, and it's not so slow and methodical as far as your gameplay objectives. So yeah, our aim is to recreate things as authentic as people would remember them, if they'd play them, you know, back in the day when they were new.
Now, let's get into a little bit of the physics there. I want to know how closely you guys model things like friction and, say, rotation. Because I'm not quite sure. I've been playing it on the Vita screen. I'm not quite sure if there's visible ball rotation as you're playing. Am I missing something?
There is visible ball rotation.
Okay.
There's a diffuse map that shows how the ball rolls.
Okay.
And one thing that we are still striving for is to get the spin of the ball implemented into our physics engine better.
Okay.
One thing that I think we do really well is we get the weight of the ball, gravity, the elasticity, the way how much the balls bounce off of things, the transfer of speed.
Yeah.
And we get things like, you know, tricks that you would do on a real table that fairly well. You know, flipper passes, dead flipper passes, post passes, you know, cradled shots. You know, there's spin has some effect, but as we're improving our engine, you know, we're already, people are calling us, you know, the best simulation, pinball simulation that's ever been made. There are several things specifically physics-wise that we know we can improve. And one of them is spin. A couple more, if you're interested, are the fact that the flippers, they accelerate at like a constant as opposed to starting off a little slower than gaining speed, which gives them a little different feel than a real machine.
Yeah.
And then there's something called a live catch and a drop catch, which are two very specific pinball techniques to control the ball that we have been working on, and we've got them like almost there, but they're a little too easy. So we took them out for now, and we'll be putting them back in as we have more time. Once we get all these launches out, you know, we came out, like I said, on mobile out in February, and now we're out on 360 and PS3 and Vita.
Now, speaking of the different platforms, I've only played the Vita version, but we did have one reader who spoke of lighting differences between the 360 and PS3 versions. Is this accurate? What's the difference in the lighting?
This is accurate. Oddly enough, I'd say 3 months ago, we were worried about the lighting being up to par on the PS3. The 360 is what the lighting, our lighting tech has been great for like the last, you know, 6 to 9 months, and that's what we've been demoing the game on. All of the videos that we put out there on the web, they've all been from the 360. And the PS3 has been behind. So we've had our, you know, our tools guys and our engine guys working on the tech for PS3. And now that they've created it, our artists have gone ahead and optimized how the tables look. It's a little different style. In addition to having a few more different tools, you know, in their toolbox as far as how to lighten things up without blowing out the colors.
Right.
So the 360 version was submitted several weeks before the PS3 was. So the lighting values in that have been released are a little dated, I guess. I mean, dated by 3 weeks. So when we're doing updates, and we're going to be continuously updating this game as we're going to be releasing, you know, our plan is to release 2 tables a month for the next 3 years. We'll be updating the lighting across the board on all the old tables. So, yeah, the PS3 lighting is a little more dynamic, more contrasty.
Kind of HDR?
Yeah, well, both of HDR.
Okay.
And, you know, that was the thing that we had to get working on the PS3. We had no HDR lighting as of a few months ago. And once we get it up and running, the artists, you know, focused on getting all the lighting values and all the HDR values, you know, looking great on the PS3. In the 360, we already, you know, knew it looked pretty good. So got the PS3 looking good, submitted, and now we'll be going back to the 360 and bringing it up to the same level, same style too.
Cool. Now, one other reader noted on the Vita version, and I noticed this too, that the leaderboard integration is a little bit insistent on linking to a Wi-Fi signal after each game instead of, say, using the approach that Super Stardust HD, Super Stardust Delta, where the scores are only transferred once a connection is made. Now, why was this method used, especially for a system that may not always have a Wi-Fi signal handy?
Well, I mean, we're on several different platforms, so I'm not sure which platform you mean.
On the Vita.
On the Vita, okay. Mm-hmm. So the Vita must have a Wi-Fi signal?
Yeah, I think after each game, it tries to connect to upload and download, you know, high scores after each one. And instead of, you know, kind of storing that information or checking if there's a signal first and then, you know, transferring information, it wants to make a connection, which is kind of, I guess, may disrupt the flow from game to game. You know, obviously not a game killer in any way, but more of a small annoyance.
Yeah, I understand. Probably because, you know, we came out on mobile first.
Mm-hmm.
On Android and iOS, and we had some issues where scores were getting posted depending on when we sent the signal to our leaderboard server for the wrong table.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming that the reason why it is the way it is right now is to try to minimize any potential erroneous score.
Okay.
Something that we're aware of that needs to improve. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, getting rid of any erroneous scores and making the user experience better.
Yeah, cool. Now, to wrap things up, can you talk about what tables may be on the horizon, perhaps dream tables that you'd like to see and acquire for Pinball Arcade?
Well, let me see what I can say. We've already announced several tables. You know, we're going to be all the tables that we did in the Williams collection and the Gottlieb collection will be coming out again, with the exception being, you know, Jive Time and maybe one other table.
Okay.
Because our license is structured in such a way that we're going to replace it with a better table.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we have a bunch of Bally tables and Stern tables to do, we've already announced, you know, Monster Bash and Creature from the Black Lagoon, Creature being one of my favorite tables of all time. So, you know, personally, I'm psyched to get that one in there. I really have a new appreciation for some of the new Bally tables that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't play as much pinball in the late 90s as I did when I was growing up in the arcade.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these tables are fairly new to me. And in getting to tune the physics and play them, I have a really fond appreciation now of, you know, Theater of Magic and some other tables, some of the more modern Bally tables. Mm-hmm. We have signed other licenses. We haven't announced any of those yet. Any other dream tables? See, I mean, there's the licenses that we have signed include several of those.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other tables that have dreams of mine that we have not signed yet. Adam's Family being one of them. There being another major license that I want to get that we're still working on. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to be cagey and not really
understand.
Not really give you too many tables. Players and users, and they can expect to get, really 12 great Bally tables over the next couple of years that we'll be doing. And when it comes to Stern, we hope to get at least that many over the next 3 years and get as many as these licenses as we can. And, you know, some of these licenses are things that are difficult to get the licensor's attention because they're big companies.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other ones that are just simply expensive.
Yeah.
So as we grow our user base and we prove that, you know, we can make a certain amount of money for our licensors on these tables, then it'll be worth their while to write up an agreement. Because these license agreements take typically 6 months. I mean, and that's if there's like no hiccups along the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a long process.
Yeah.
So, you know, once we can prove that we're viable, then it's to the licensors, it's going to be worth their while to have their licensed people and have their lawyers draw up agreements. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, again, sorry I'm not announcing any new tables right now, but our plan is, you know, Medieval Madness and Bride of Pinbot are on Android now, and they'll be coming out on all the platforms. And we haven't announced the next two tables after that, but they're really far along. So very soon, on our Facebook page and on our web page, we'll be showing some videos of those tables soon.
Okay, very cool. Looking forward to it. And thank you so much for your time, Bobby. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Robert.
Pokemon Pinball, remember that?
Yes, I love that thing. GBA, baby. Love
that. Hell yeah.
Okay. Guys.
Hello? Yes.
You guys ready for trivia?
I'm ready for some football.
Football? In the middle of April? Mm-hmm. I can't accommodate that request, but I can give you no less than 7 trivia questions. Tonight, we're honoring the passing of Jack Tramiel.
Very sad.
So, yeah, I think it's appropriate to we honor the man who made home computers affordable for the average home by offering some good old Commodore trivia. And my first computer was the Commodore 64.
Was it?
That thing, yeah. I learned to program on that thing in BASIC, even some assembly language, and... Man, I spent at least 2 summers on that thing.
Glued. Nice.
Yeah. Surprised I don't have carpal tunnel syndrome. So, question number 1. Let's start with an easy one. What year was the company's flagship computer, the Commodore 64, released? Was it A, 1980, B, 1981, C, 1982, or D, 1983?
82.
I'm going to go with 81.
I kind of want to say 81 also.
Who said 1982, Sage?
Me.
You would be correct.
Yep, I know.
Oh, you
damn it.
No. Come on.
I do know. I know when all the computers came out.
You know, okay. What year did the Apple IIe or the Apple II GS come out?
No, I know when all of the Commodore computers came out, not all the computers
Big
in 20. Existence.
Big 20. Amiga. What year did the Amiga 500 come out?
Dude, I don't know.
Sega CD.
The ENIAC. When did the ENIAC happen? Tell us.
The ENIAC?
Yeah, the big...
The what?
Sure, the vacuum tube computer, the big room.
Oh. Dude, I don't... Okay.
Mega Nomad.
I am not that big a nerd. I don't know all of the years of all of the computers, okay?
Something, the combustion engine, or... No, what was that called? Oh, well, never mind. Trivia has hit a tangent, but we'll get it back on track. Number 2, which network got its start as a Commodore 64-only bulletin board system? Was it A, CompuServe, B, Genie, C, AOL, or D, Prodigy?
Oh, fuck.
I'm sorry.
Genie?
Is not a answer.
I want to say Genie.
Was it called Genie or G-E-E-N-E?
G-E-E-N-E. Well, they didn't want it to be confused with Degenie, and so they wanted it to be Genie.
That's making me think of a game. What game? I don't know. Okay, guys, what other answer? Blue.
What was B again?
Genie.
Eeny? Okay, I'll go with Eeny too.
How about the Prodigy?
And the correct answer, the most obvious, AOL.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
No, it wasn't, because I had a non-Commodore computer that AOL was on.
It was called AOL.
Well, it's obvious now. Oh, I should have got that.
So that was a trick question, so fuck you.
Number three, moving on. Over the years, Commodore 64 became the best-selling personal computer of all time. Just how many units were moved? A, 15 million, B, 18 million, C, 22 million, or D, 27 million?
You know how I am with numbers, Robert.
I think I'm going to go with 18 million.
41597. I'm sorry?
I'm going to go with 18 million.
18, okay.
I want to say it crossed 20. I'm going to go with 22.
Okay. Sage?
What are the numbers again?
Oh, my gosh. Number four. 15, 18, 22, 27.
27. I know it was over $1 billion worth, so I don't know how many that is. 27.
Correct answer. Jeremy gets it. 22 million.
Damn it.
Ooh, crap. Yes.
Number four, immediately before the Commodore 64, the company infiltrated homes with another machine. Name it. Is it A, the Amiga, B, the VIC-20, C, the Trash 80, or D, the ZX-81?
The VIC-20.
I agree.
Jeremy?
Yeah, that is the VIC-20, yes.
You said the Trash 80? No, no. You guys are all correct. I'm going to throw that one out. That was too easy. That was
Dude, fuck you!
You should have started with that. Give us some confidence.
Yeah.
Number five.
Breaking our souls.
Yes. I am the Prinny. Number five. I'm sure you know the Commodore's first computer was the PET. Just what did the PET stand for? Was it A, the Primary Electronic Terminal? B, the Processor Electronic Transactions? C, the Personal Electronic Transactor? Or D, the Primary Educational Terminal?
C.
I'm going to go with C, too.
Really? I'm not going to go with C. I'm going to go with A.
Correct answer, C.
Eat
yes.
It. How did you guys know that, or did you guess?
No, it's the personal, because that was what their whole thing was. He wanted to, instead of making a big like server computer for companies, he wanted to make computers something that were a personal device at home.
Wow. Who knew Sage was such the Commodore?
That is profound.
Yeah. Well, dude, he was sort of a big deal. Not to mention his decision to back out of the Atari video game market is what left it wide open for Nintendo. And I love Nintendo, so I love that he fucked that up.
Okay.
What a wonderful trivia.
Six. Ask any historian about the old pets and they'll likely mention the killer poke. Just what the hell does this even mean? A, sticking a finger into the floppy disk drive can give you a nasty laceration. B, writing to a certain software command, called a poke, can actually kill the built-in CRT. C, one of the first digitized sound samples heard on the machine was a grainy recreation of porn star Linda Lovelace having an orgasm.
What the fuck, Robert,
I just need to say, Robert, nobody appreciates the time you put into this trivia. I don't think anybody really appreciates it.
Sorry.
Okay. No. I'm saying it's good, but I don't think anybody really understands.
Yes. Sorry. Thank you for recognizing that. D, turning on the machine without grounding yourself often gave users a strong, but fortunately harmless, electronic shock.
Oh, no. Wait, what was B?
Linda Lovelace, writing a certain software command could actually kill the built-in CRT.
That one.
That sounds good to me, too. And I'm not just saying it because you said it, Sage.
That's all right. You can copy me. It's fine.
That's right, because you can either poke or you can pop. And so peek. I'm also going to go with
you
that.
You can peek.
You can peek. That's right. You can poke or peek.
That's disgusting. You guys are disgusting.
You can
correct answer, Linda Lovelace. No, I'm kidding. Correct answer, yes. Certain software command called the poke. Number seven, and this is not multiple choice. This is going to be your guess. So are you guys ready?
I'm ready.
Numbers. I warn you now, Sage, there's at least a few numbers.
God damn it, Deagle. You need to write them out for me.
A mix of 12% hydrogen peroxide, UV sunlight, and a small amount of Oxy Laundry Booster creates an amalgam known as Retro Bright. Just how can this concoction help a Commodore 64?
What kind of fucking bullshit question is this?
It's a legit one. Retro Bright.
Let's see. I'm going to guess that it can clean...
Okay, guys, look at the ingredients. 12% hydrogen peroxide, UV sunlight, small amount of Oxy Laundry Booster.
I mean...
Okay, I'm going to guess it's to take, like, if the Commodore or whatever yellows, like some of the old Super Nintendos. Yeah. I'm going to say it takes that out.
I'm going to say it's for bleaching the Commodore so that it's not yellow and crappy looking anymore.
Getting the Bill Clinton stains off it.
Yes.
Yes, Blue nailed it. That is reverse yellowing that is caused by what they do is they add bromine, which is a fire retardant used in plastics. So you want to refurbish your Commodore 64, return it to its wonderful pristine color. You take
Android off. Or 360. If there's like Doritos stains on it.
Yes.
Those Doritos Locos Tacos from Taco Bell.
Does it work on an SNES, though?
Yes.
I believe so, yeah.
Works on everything.
Most any kind of plastic.
You know what else is kind of cool? Fucking Jack Tramiel was a Holocaust survivor.
Yes.
Wow.
He survived in Auschwitz and actually got his start repairing the U.S. Army, taught him how to build or how to repair typewriters.
Yep. And he met his wife, who was also a Holocaust survivor, and he married her at like 18, 19.
Wait, he was 18 or she was?
No, he was. He was 16 when he went to Auschwitz, and then when he left, he met her, and she was also a survivor, and they got married at like 18. And he has three sons, and they all look so Jewish.
Okay, didn't expect that one. I know one of them's name is Sam, and he ran Commodore at one time. Yeah.
Until he had a heart attack, and then Jack took back over in 95, I think.
Mm, yeah. Amazing story, and a great man, and a great contributor to our industry.
And you know what you should have brought up, because this is actually video game related.
Tell me, Sage.
The Jack attack.
Jack attack?
Yeah, Jack Attack came from him.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because he was like this super hard ass kind of guy, and he'd like buy a new company and fire everybody, and when he'd get mad, he would like get really red in the face and just be like, and so they decided to name Jack Attack after him, and he knew and sort of thought it was funny and allowed it to happen.
Sure. It could have been when you get the runs after Jack in the Box.
That's disgusting. Why?
That was the Taco Bell.
You got mad at me for being innuendo-y and you have to throw in a disgusting, not even funny poop joke? Why?
That was not innuendo. That was just straight in your face.
I know. Mine's better.
Here's some diarrhea in your face.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Can we talk about anything else besides that?
We have questions. Don't worry.
Thank God.
Yes. Our first question comes from Merker. Anyway, question for the show. What E3 announcements, real or imagined, would you like to hear?
Oh my god.
Hmm.
I would love to hear that the Wii U has amazing new developments that it make it really, really cool, and that there's gonna be an awesome holographic Mario RPG game like no other has ever been. That's what I want.
Okay. How about a realistic one?
I said what I want, real or imagined. That's
real or imagined. That counts.
All right.
Wonder about. I mean,
I guess they're all going to be imagined because they haven't been announced yet. So.
Well, that's true.
What do you want?
I mean, one thing I'd like to do is hear about new IPs instead of just sequels. I'm excited for the new generation of consoles, but I really want to see some experiences or play some experiences that feel fresh. Don't make me get on my soapbox, but the last 2 years has kind of given us this increasing amount of cinematic games, I think, that deliver these series of amazing set pieces, and I think, Jeremy, you kind of spoke of this, but it's also at the expense of expression. I remember playing the old, like, Ghost Recon games and kind of using different strategies. You map your strategy out, you know, you pick your floor. And now when you play those type of games, you kind of work your way through level to level, and it's almost like, I don't know, the Autotopia at Disneyland. You can kind of veer slightly to the left or right, but you're on the figurative track where you're constantly guided through the game. And so, I don't know, I'm really hoping that maybe the new generation of consoles offer this ultimate sandbox experience where you can really, you know, do anything you want, go anywhere, be the person you'd like to be, whether that's, you know, the ultimate douchebag or the ultimate superhero.
Totally. So
that experience.
I don't know, though. I mean, it sounds like you're kind of talking about this, you know, two different sides of the same thing. I mean, you're talking about creative constraint, you know, and I think that it's pretty well accepted that people will get more creative when they have bounds, you know, to live within. And, I mean, we're just now getting to the point where people are you know, maxing out the hardware that we have. And it's 6 years old, it's true, but as soon as we give people more RAM or more horsepower or whatever, I mean, they're just going to throw that stuff into, you know. So
The one thing actually, I would like to see is better AI. I think that is where it really... I think that would improve games. Where
totally.
Skyrim does that. Skyrim's AI is, well, when it's not, you know, kind of glitchy or something.
Are you kidding me?
Huh.
Have you seen the video of the guy and he gets shot in the fucking eyeball with the arrow and he's like, is someone there? And then he waits a minute and he blinks.
Put the bucket on
and he's
head.
Like, and then he's like, oh, I guess not. And then he goes back to what he's doing with the arrow still coming out of his eye.
Yeah, but you almost have to give Skyrim a pass because it's trying to do so much. And yeah, you're going to find there's so much programming. There's so much embedded within that world that there's going to be glitches and things.
Sure,
like.
But then don't tout them as the like upholders of decent AI. You know what was decent AI? Fucking Splinter Cell before Conviction. If that's the other thing I want. I want Splinter Cell to go back to the pre-Conviction days before it became bullshit because the AI had gotten really fucking good.
Yeah, that was a lot of AI was a lot of fun to fuck with.
Actually, on Jeremy's. Jeremy told me that the original Splinter Cell games, the HD collection, it was still kind of stood up there. And so I picked up that and I was playing the original Splinter Cell. And despite the really awful lip sync and kind of the graphics are a little bit crap, they were so much fun to play still.
I know, right? Yeah.
Have you guys ever tried like taking like soda cans and spiking the guards in the back of the head and then sneaking off to the other side of the room?
No, Blue, but you've talked about it 3 times on our show.
I haven't talked about it 3 times, have I?
Yes.
3 times?
August 18th.
It says it right here in the outline, actually.
Blue, bring up soda cans. Yes, you bring up soda cans every time we mention Splinter Cell. Yes,
I'm sorry, it's just so much fun.
Yes, we know.
That's for real.
Well, that's fun. And I mean, I think messing around with AI is really a lot of fun. And you know, Deagle, I think that you are, I mean, I think you're on the right track. I don't think that, I mean, are any of you feeling like we need better graphics?
No. Nope.
Do we need, I mean, I think we've pretty well, I feel like I could be happy for a pretty long time with the graphical fidelity that we have in this generation. So I think, and I think a lot of people say that the best place to go after that is, you know, some of the stuff under the hood, you know, the other kinds of processing, and AI, I think is definitely going to be where some of that goes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, cool.
For me, I actually kind of go the opposite way from Deagle there. I mean, absolutely we love to have new experiences, but I have actually, I'm a person who, as a gamer, is defined almost entirely by my backlog. And I have personally really enjoyed the Sony, primarily a little bit of Microsoft doing some of it, but the re-releases, the HD collections that have come out. And I have so many things from the last gen still in shrink wrap that I haven't played and haven't even gotten around to. The one, if I had to think of one, my wife and I have had you know, a pretty good time playing through Kingdom Hearts. Yeah. Whatever you might think about Kingdom Hearts, but how awesome would a Kingdom Hearts HD collection be if they were to remaster
that
and bring
good.
That out.
Yeah.
And I think, and I know that team is kind of working on a lot of different things, but they could also use that as a springboard to maybe announce like Kingdom Hearts 3, maybe.
I could get beyond that.
some hopefulness there.
Yeah, and I mean, they've been releasing. I mean, the stuff that is just standalone. You know, a lot of the old, really old stuff. Choplifter came out a while ago. Jordan Mechner just announced that he's going to be doing Karateka. You know, I mean, I personally, I'm way excited for Karateka because a little bit of trivia about me. It was the very first game I ever beat, and So I'm looking forward to that.
I think I beat that too.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, here's the thing. My babysitter was, I think I was like 4 or 5 years old, and my babysitter was there, and she's like, "Oh, you're so good." It was like one of the best experiences of my life, beating Karateka.
An acknowledgement from the babysitter.
It's true. So, I mean, she was a hot babysitter, too.
Oh. So, Lawman, you and your wife actually play video games together?
Sometimes. I mean, Kingdom Hearts is sort of her little project. I think she got into it mostly because of the Disney aspect of it. But, you know, we got the strategy guides, and, you know, she was always concerned, like, oh, I don't do very well with maps and things like that. So Kingdom Hearts was kind of our little project together. And she's kind of fallen off the wagon a little bit to the casual games. But yeah. I feel like, and especially now, you know, my backwards compatible PS3 burned up. So I can't go back to the PS2 games unless we go to the Spirit Room or whatever. So I know, I was really bummed. I had hoped that thing would last me the rest of my life, but but if they were to re-release that on a Blu-ray, you know, I'd be back in business. I'd be able to, you know, get some Kingdom Hearts action with the wife.
You know, I'm Ratchet and Clank the collection. I'm there day one. I love the Ratchet and Clank games, except for the last bastardization that ruined everything about what I love about the series. So I'm with you on the HD collections.
A little dramatic.
I'm not. Have you played the most recent Ratchet and Clank?
It's all for one.
Yeah, they screwed that all to hell. I just bought it again because it dropped down to $20, and I figured maybe I was grumpy that they changed so much. So I started playing it again. I was like, this is no fun. They ruined everything about it.
I think as far as fantasy announcements go for me, I'd love to see, like, Nintendo especially, maybe Sega, whatever, release a retro console line, maybe like a limited run of like the original Super Nintendo or the original NES, something like that. Because I mean, let's face it, a lot of the ones that, a lot of the systems that came out originally, I mean, they're gonna die sooner or later. I mean, the Super NES, I got as my first system. I mean, that died
out.
You
know, if Sega did it, it would plug in, it would have Wi-Fi, and as soon as you boot it up, you can play 5 games, and they charge you $5 for each additional game. I'm kidding.
Well, you know, they have that, Blue, I don't know if you know, they've got that Retro Duo, or they've got some consoles, just some third-party consoles that people have made, too, that allegedly work pretty well.
I've heard about those. I've heard that they also have sometimes they can have emulation issues, like music will be screwy or graphics will be screwy, and it's not like 100% perfect emulation.
With the Retro Duo, I didn't have a problem, but you got to plug in controllers because the ones that they come with are wireless, but they're line of sight, so they suck. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no,
first
it's not,
world
not
problems.
Bad. Line of sight. We got another question from Keyboard Cat. Sing the song, Blue.
Meow 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 meow.
Okay, now the damn song. Gonna have to cut that. I'd like a discussion on how Kickstart might change the nature of gaming. And what do you think the first Kickstart fail will be? Sage?
Why do you go to me first for the naysaying?
Fail.
Okay. Jeremy, tell me.
Actually, I find this very interesting because the thing that I've noticed about Kickstarter when it comes to games is that almost, I'm trying to think if there's any exception to this, but almost without exception, the things that are being funded through Kickstarter are things that, you know, we've talked for a long time. We should get another, you know, I'd love to see another game from Tim Schafer. I'd love to see another, going back and revisiting series that, that people have wanted to go back to. Right. And so, it's really almost like a grassroots thing, like a groundswell of support. And obviously people are supporting with their money. And, you know, I think that in terms of changing the nature of gaming, I don't know that it'll change the nature of gaming, but I think that you know, this is a situation where people really are literally voting with their dollars on what they want to see. And, you know, I think that they, you know, a lot of publishers have been going back to the well a little bit, but, you know, the next thing we're going to see, you know, is a Final Fantasy VII fan-funded, you know, official remake around the corner. You know, maybe, I don't know. I don't know that it's completely out of the picture.
But that's valid, I think, because those things can be so amazing. Like, I think fans get a better idea of what the feel of a game is that appeals to them and what... Like, if that feel were there more, how it would make the game better. In some ways, I think that fans make some of the best, you know, sort of, not programmers, but designers of sort of the next game and how they want it to look and everything. And the reason that I faltered on the fail question is because I don't know that I think that they're going to fail necessarily. I think, like Jeremy's saying, people actually being able to vote with their dollars and people actually being able to produce something that is their own. I mean, it reminds me of the 61, which is the music website where people can sort of put their own music up and then other people can buy it if they want to. And that has become an actual legitimate jumping platform for musicians. And I think mm-hmm. that this is the same kind of thing, but for games, I think it's really phenomenal.
Well, one interesting thing I think on Kickstarter is the emphasis that has moved from the quality of your final product, which is, you know, articulated through previews and reviews, to the creativity of the design. I mean, there's been this shift in giving your money to a game that you read about or that you've seen, one that looks really amazing, to one that hasn't even started yet. And knowing games take at least 6 months to maybe 3 years, in the case of Fez, 5 years, I wonder how that's going to feel when the game finally comes to market, you know, that waiting time. And I'm to answer the question about failure, I'm sure that there will be a failure. It will be inevitable when the developer, you know, blows money on whores and booze and submits a crappy product that everybody chimed in there. I don't want that to happen, but I think that will, I don't know, you know, developers right
it's
now,
so
they're given money. And
so there's one fail, and then, but there's a lot of good that comes out of it. Who cares?
But I think people will point towards Kickstart and say, you know, there may be some reluctance. They're going to pick on the medium.
Well, I think Kickstart is actually going to, like, jump the shark. Because it's like you're hearing about all these, oh, this person is starting a Kickstarter project, and this person is starting a Kickstarter project. When are they going to jump the shark with these things?
What do you mean?
I don't know that they're really going to jump a shark. In fact, I really think the opposite. I mean, I think this is really the beginning of something that we're going to be hearing about for a long time. But mm-hmm. I think part of the question, too, about what the first Kickstart fail will be, and I guess I had originally thought about it in terms of, you know, a project not being funded, which I guess could be something different. But think about this. Even projects, even games that, I mean, bad games come out all the time, right? Games get panned all the time. What if it's the game that you, not only that you paid for, but that you really, really wanted to come out? Mm-hmm. I mean, people are going to take that really hard, and I mean, it's going to happen eventually. I mean, you know, you cannot, when it comes to development, you cannot go from the start of that project and know with 100% certainty how that development cycle is going to go or what's going to happen or what challenges you're going to face. And in the past, I mean, in the sort of the traditional, you know, publisher-developer relationship, the publisher is there to absorb that. You know, they will, you know, they'll drive the developers, they'll give them some motivation, hold back bonuses, get them on track. If there are setbacks in the timeline, they, you know, they are the pockets, you know, and if this is something that's funded to a finite amount, what happens when the money runs dry for whatever reason?
Mm-hmm. But again, I don't think that that's a fail, because I think that people seeing where their money is going and that projects don't always pan out and that sometimes things don't work out the way you hoped it would will introduce to people. Well, no, because what it introduces to people is the idea that anyone in the creative business already knows legitimately, and that people who are in the consumer side of things take for granted, which is that, no, not every project, shut up, not every project works out the way you want it to. Not every project turns out the way you want it to. And I still don't think that that's a bad thing. It'll be a disappointment that's like, oh,
let's say no. Let's say Mass Effect 3 was kickstarted in our imaginary world, right. And then the ending happened, Oh my god.
And here's the other thing too.
Don't say anything about it.
I mean, the contributors in this case, they are not producers. They don't have any creative control over the project. They're basically saying, yes, based on what you put on this web page, it looks good to me. Here's $150 to get my super, you know, gold tier bonus, you know, poster with everybody signing. But so, you know, I guess maybe somebody could be happy that their $150, you know, kind of just, you know, just kind of goes away. But I don't
contribute money that you didn't have. I mean, have you guys never contributed money to like an Indiegogo film project? Like, I've done that before and I don't have a lot of money, so I do like $5. And if it comes out and it's a great like little independent film, I'm like, cool, I had a part in that. That's fucking awesome. And if it comes out crappy, I'm like, well, I put some money into something I believed would work. It was the amount of money I could afford. It didn't work out. I have learned the lesson that everyone should learn when they're six, which is that sometimes disappointment happens. And if people really have not learned that lesson yet, then yes, that is a great thing for them to realize that, one, if you don't have $200 to put into a game, then don't put in 20. And two, sometimes you're going to be disappointed. And that doesn't make Kickstarter a bad thing because they're providing that opportunity.
Okay. What was that? Indiegogo?
Indiegogo, the website Indiegogo. That's like this for films.
Oh, okay. Didn't hear about that.
Oh, it's been around for like forever, right, dude.
Thanks for rubbing it in my face.
You're fucking welcome.
I didn't know about it either.
Well, you guys are just not in the know. What the fuck, man? We're supposed to be like the nerdy people.
I don't like indie movies.
But so what? Have you never seen a non-Hollywood movie that you liked?
Well, put it this way. I don't go out of my way to watch something that is specifically indie.
That one with Linda Lovelace.
God damn it, Deagle. Do you need to get laid? What is your problem?
That's disgusting.
All right. So, should we round out the show on that note?
Probably.
good time. The time is right.
Yes.
The time is right for you to go get laid. Go forth, my son.
Doing it right now. Anyway, outro.
Yeah.
I'm like,
you and Linda Lovelace.
Yes, and those Santa Fe cops.
And the Santa Fe cops.
Okay, guys, if you'd like to compliment your listening with a bit of reading, I suggest checking out www.techgaming.com for the latest reviews, editorials, and weekly new releases. New one went up today. If you'd like our opinions on gaming, pretty much anything else, you can follow us on Twitter. We're going to introduce ourselves today. I'm Robert Allen at tech_gaming. Let me pass the torch to you, Blue.
I am Blue Swim, BLUESWIM.
Are you reading your title?
Oh,
this will kill it.
It's just as well.
Oh, I am the DLC heel.
That was not.
That was totally worth it. I'm glad we did that.
Wow, that was an epic fail. Lawman. How can we
I am Jeremy_Lamont. That's J-E-R-E-M. Yeah, you'd be amazed how many different ways there are to spell Jeremy. It's pretty amazing. Jeremy Lamont, L-A-M-O-N-T.
You got to say it, Lamont.
And there's Lamont. Actually, it's Scottish, actually. So it's Jeremy_Lamont. Yeah, it's Scottish. It's actually, in fact, here's a little bit of trivia also. Lamont means lawman. It's actually from the Gaelic word for lawman, so it means sheriff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so your nickname's redundant.
It is
a little bit. It's a little bit like saying ATM machine.
I hate that. Speaking of hate, I am Sage Samurage Morris Green. You can follow me on Twitter at Samurage, SAMURAGE. And you can follow all of us on Facebook if you go to Tech Gaming and like us. And then you'll get all our updates for our website as well.
TechGaming.com.
Yeah, TechGaming.com.
I'm not cool enough to be on Facebook. Well, actually, don't forget, Missing in Action is Sean Nola Kirkland at Sean, N-O-L-A, two N's.
Absolutely. Yeah. We love him. We miss him. We hope that he... We hope to never diss him. Ha, ha. Just for you guys, the bad rhythmic stylings of Sam Rage.
Swinging in the backyard, pull up in your fast car, whistling my name. Open up a beer and you say get over here and play a video game. I'm in his favorite sundress, watching me get undressed, take that body downtown. I say you're the bestest, leaning for a big kiss. Put his favorite perfume on, go play your video game. It's you, it's you, it's all for you. Everything I do, I tell you all the time. Heaven is a place on earth with you. Tell me all the things you wanna do. I heard that you like the bad girls, honey. Is that true? It's better than I ever even knew. They say that the world was built for two. Only worth living if somebody is loving you. Baby, now. In the old bar, swinging with the old stars, living for the fame. Kissing in the blue dark, playing, pulling wild darts, video games. He holds me in his big arms, drunk and I am seeing stars. This is all I think of. Watching all our friends fall in and out of old clothes. This is my idea of fun. Playing video games. It's you, it's you, it's all for you. Everything I do, I tell you all the time. Heaven is a place on earth.